Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. This is internet talk radio that you can access worldwide by simply going to redicecreations.com. Check out our website with our news, our forum, and of course our free archive of fascinating radio programs dating back to April of this year. Today we got an awesome program with Jerry E. Smith lined up for you. We are going to talk about weather modification and the technology involved and the documented history on this subject. Later we'll continue our talk with Jerry in our subscriber section on the possible creation of the global warming scenario. And what about solar system warming? There is a completely different story here that we're not being told. And this is the most fascinating interview I've done on weather manipulation and on global warming. So to all our wonderful subscribers, just access the archive and download the show. I highly recommend it. Don't miss this one. If you're not a subscriber and want to hear more, simply click on that subscribe or sign up button and come aboard with us. You'll get access to all of our wonderful interviews, and at the same time you'll help to support this radio program and the website. Before we get to today's show, I'd like to say thank you to Alan Watt for talking with us last week about money, magic, and the origins of words. Alan will be back the last Sunday again of next month, and we're going to begin our talk then on the microchip. Alan is a regular every month, and we're very glad to have him, so don't miss it. Okay, so next up, Jerry E. Smith on weather modification. Do stay tuned and enjoy the show. Today we have Jerry E. Smith back with us on the program, and he has recently been on talking about his book Spear of Destiny, The Secrets of the Holy Lands, a fascinating program that you definitely shouldn't miss, but if you did, just head on over to our archives and check it out. And we also had Jerry on back in June when we talked about his HARP book and, you know, the antenna array up in Alaska and about HARP technology and so forth. And we are going to take that discussion further today because Jerry's here today to talk about his newest book, which is called Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature. And I think that this is extremely important stuff, especially considering the changes that are happening now with our climate on our planet. And we get reports basically daily on environmental issues and the media blitz, I guess you could call it, on the global warming issue and the debate on what it all is about and so forth. And I want to get into that a bit later in the interview, of course, also. But this question regarding weather modification is still, you know, looked upon as a fringe conspiracy theory, I guess. And but after, I think, looking at a few of the topics in Jerry's book and that he connects a lot of this stuff to official military documents and official news reports and so forth, there's no question regarding the fact that this technology do exist and is reality a conspiracy fact more than a theory. And but most of us have never heard about this because you have to go dig deep for this kind of information. So I'm very glad to have Jerry here today to talk about this. And so welcome back to the program, Jerry. It's very nice to have you here again. Thanks for coming on.
Well, hi. It's good to be back.
Excellent. And you keep producing interesting material, Jerry. I guess that this is your kind of your follow-up book to your book about HARP. Is that correct?
Exactly. My first book for Adventures Unlimited Press was HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy. And again, HARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. And then my second book, which came out last summer, was Secrets of the Holy Lands, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend. And then just now, as we speak, this book is arriving at the national distributor, so it should be hitting the bookstores in another week or two. And this book is Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature. And they may seem like rather different ideas, different areas, but all three books have a single overarching topic, which is I write about the people I call the control freaks. I write about those who would rule us, those who would rule the world. I got a good quote here I'm trying to flip to that I opened the last chapter of Weather Warfare with. And this is from Daniel Webster, one of the first-generation Americans. And he wrote, "There are men in all ages who mean to govern well, but they mean to govern. They promise to be good masters, but they mean to be masters." And so that's really what I write about. And in HAARP and Weather Warfare, I talk about those who would use the most advanced technologies to control us. And then in Secrets of the Holy Lands, George, my co-author, and I discuss how they have used the most esoteric, arcane, and ancient of technologies, i.e. religion and magic, to control us.
Yeah, I mean, regarding quote, I have to read one here. This is from the Duke of Brunswick, and this is the Grand Master of World Freemason, and this is in the 1700s. He said, "I have been convinced that we as an order have come under the power of some very evil occult order, profoundly versed in science, both occult and otherwise. Though not infallible, their methods being black magic, that is to say, electromagnetic power, hypnotism and powerful suggestion." So, I mean, there you go. There, and this is back in the 1700s. I mean, this in some sense ties into what we're dealing with today, I guess.
Absolutely. there is, as you pointed out in your opening comments, there is a vast gulf between what people think they know and what is reality.
Yeah.
One of the areas is weather modification. Weather modification has been an off-the-shelf technology for 60 years. It has been under development for 150 years. Right now, as we speak, the Chinese government has 35,000 people employed full-time in the field of weather management, and they spend $40 million a year in suppressing hail, teasing more rain out of clouds, dissipating fogs over airports, and that sort of thing. This is not science fiction. This is an everyday multi-million dollar technology.
Yeah, of course. And that was one of my questions here to, find out how far back we have to go. And I know that you, in your HAARP book, go somewhat into Nikola Tesla and talk about that. And obviously, I guess he has something to do with all of this too here.
Well, it goes back, to the Napoleonic Wars. I think you could start there because generals and a number of other folks noticed during great battles often were followed by great rainstorms. And after the American Civil War of the 1860s, a couple of generals recognized this, and one actually got a patent in the 1870s or 80s for a rainmaking technology based on that observation that great battles tend to seem to produce great rainstorms. And he came up with what he called the concussion theory of rainmaking, in which he believed that it was the explosions of the battle that produced the rain. We now know that the smoke of battle actually is what did it, that the smoke provides a nucleating substance, that is something around which water molecules can collect and become heavy enough to fall to Earth.
Interesting.
The United States government allocated $20,000 in the 1890s to investigate this, and actually had the Secretary of Commerce, Secretary of the Interior, send out teams to investigate these theories. Whether rain making became a popular activity in the 1890s. It initially posed some solutions and some problems, and the problems have yet to be resolved. And a major piece of the problems are legal problems, in that it's very difficult. The courts have been unable to rule on tort issues regarding weather modification, and part of this is that the mainstream of American science says, We haven't made up our mind yet. We don't know whether this stuff works or not, and we're not going to say it does work until we absolutely know without any doubts or reservations that it works. So there have been 100 years of lawsuits and confusion. This has just snowballed into bigger and bigger problems as we come into the common era.
Yeah. I mean, this reminds me regarding the Gunsmoke and this stuff. I guess our way you do that today is by cloud seeding, correct?
Exactly. Cloud seeding really got off the ground quite literally in 1948-49 when Dr. Bernard Vonnegut figured out how to use silver iodine as a nucleating factor in clouds and produced rain with it. Dr. Vonnegut was the younger brother of the famous author Kurt Vonnegut Jr.
So, I mean, if we have been using this kind of stuff for about more than 50 years now.
Yeah, coming up on 60 years.
60 years, yeah. I mean, couldn't this stuff basically, I mean, mess with the you know, the balance of the planet, basically, because we are, you know, putting rain into areas where there might not have been so much rain before.
Well, that is one of the big arguments for and against weather modification. Mm. Is from the very beginning, from the very first days of the rainmakers in the 1890s, people were throwing up their hands and saying, "This goes contrary to God. This goes contrary to the natural flow of things."
Yeah.
This is the Mother Nature would, you know, what was the, there was a TV commercial back about 30 years ago whose tagline was, "It's not nice to fool Mother Nature." And we're running into that. That has been a big piece of this debate all along.
Yeah.
Is, again, if you, as you said, if I make it rain over here and it would have rained naturally over there, do the people over there have a right to sue me for my stealing their rain from them?
Exactly, and I mean this is one of the big debates currently going on, because there have been massive droughts, allegedly at least in various places in Africa and stuff like this. And I mean this could be because of the fact that there have been using these cloud seeding technologies in other regions around the world, basically.
That is a good observation. It's very difficult to quantify this. It's very difficult to get this nailed down.
Yeah.
Because the governments of the world do what their scientists tell them to do. And the scientists saying, "Well, we don't think it works." So those who are doing it are largely either rogue military or private industry. The big exception, of course, being the government of China. In the U.S., the U.S. Meteorological Society says we don't think it works, and so the U.S. government is in a rather awkward position. And the U.S. government is one of the leaders in using weather as a weapon. This goes back to a very long ways. The U.S. government used environmental modification techniques against the Indians during the Indian Wars of the 1840s through 70s. The U.S. government realized that the Plains Indian economy was based on the buffalo. Mm. If they killed the buffalo, they killed the Indian. And they drove the buffalo almost to extinction, then brought the Indian to his knees. Seeing the success of that tactic, they tried it again in Vietnam in the 1960s and 70s.
Mm.
For about 8 or 9 years, there were two concurrent programs running in Southeast Asia. One was called Operation Popeye, and this was to cloud seeding over the Ho Chi Minh Trail in hopes of turning the Viet Cong resupply line into an impassable quagmire of mud. The other was dropping defoliants on the jungle, Agent Orange, Agent White, and so on.
Mm.
And these were not just to clear paths and roads, as we were told. This was actually to destroy the jungle itself, because they saw that the jungle provided cover, shelter, sustenance for the enemy. Therefore, if the jungle were gone, the enemy would no longer have that sustenance and shelter. It was the impact of this when the United States Senate discovered what was going on. Senator Claiborne Pell, a Democrat from Rhode Island, absolutely freaked out and went, "My God, we can't allow this to happen."
Yeah.
And he insisted that there should be an international treaty to prevent it from happening. And his work led to the what is called the ENMOD Treaty, which is a treaty that does ban the hostile use of environmental modification techniques in disputes between nations. But it is a horribly flawed treaty, and it's essentially ignored by the international community today.
Yeah, because if it is, as you say, either a rogue network or a, you know, kind of business, you know, criminals doing this stuff, then they can do all the legislation they want, but because we have people who doesn't care about that, basically.
Exactly. One of the things I bring up in the book and bring up repeatedly to drive this in is that prior to the U.S. becoming signatory to this treaty, the U.S. had over 700 degreed scientists working full-time on weather and environmental modification, and the U.S. government was spending upwards of $20 million a year in developing the technology. And right after we went signatory to this, the U.S. government said, "Oh, no, we're not doing that," stopped all funding, and all these jobs disappeared. And I maintain they went black, that the United States government realized that being able to control the weather was an essential in fighting modern war, and that they suddenly found themselves with this treaty problem, and they simply took it all all underground, and it's somewhere in the underground matrix right now. And one of the things I point out in both my first book on HARP and in this one is that HARP is a part of this matrix of environmental modification. The U.S. Air Force steadfastly states we do not want to control the weather, but they also state and have spent vast amounts of money on modifying the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Now you tell me what the difference between those two are.
Exactly. I mean, it's totally disconnected to say, I mean, from the official standpoint of the government, to say that we don't believe that this stuff, you know, exists, because as you have brought out a quote from United States Secretary of Defense William Cohen,
I was just going to read that quote.
Yeah, do that, please.
Okay. This is from U.S. Secretary of Defense William S. Cohen was speaking at a conference on terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, U.S. strategy in 1997. And at that point he said, and I quote, "There are some reports, for example, that some countries have been trying to construct something like an Ebola virus. That would be a very dangerous phenomenon, to say the least. Alvin Toffler has written about this in terms of some scientists in their laboratories trying to devise certain types of pathogens that would be ethnic-specific so they could just eliminate certain ethnic groups and races. And others are designing some sort of engineering, some sort of insect that can destroy specific crops. Others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism, whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. So there are plenty of ingenious minds out there that are at work finding ways in which they can wreak terror upon other nations."
Yeah.
"It's real, and that's the reason why we have to intensify our efforts." Now, that was the United States Secretary of Defense. That is an official statement of U.S. policy.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, exactly. That we are right there in black and white. And, of course, we have things like Air Force 2025 owning the weather. I mean, what's that all about?
Well, that is, it's not policy, but it is something that could be used to build policy and weapon systems on. Every few years, the Secretary of the Air Force asks the Air Force Air College to put their heads together, and the students and professors team up with local experts, and they try to answer the question, what is it that we will need in the future to win future wars? And they've done this several times. Air Force 2025 is the most recent one, which was done in the mid-1990s. And that looked into the future to the year 2025 to answer the question, what technologies, operational capabilities, what redesign do we need to have in order to be the dominant air and space force on the planet in the year 2025? Now, this came out as a series of white papers prepared by the students and professors at the Air College. And I believe it was a total of like 41 papers covering something like 3,700 pages. Now, this superseded the previous one, which was called Spacecast 2020. So they've been at this for a while. And in both Spacecast 2020 and Air Force 2025, they look at weather modification, control of the weather, as a operational necessity. And both papers say outright, we need to own the weather. And in Air Force 2025, they acknowledge that there is the United Nations Convention prohibiting the use of environmental modification technology for hostile purposes. If, and this is the big if, in order for it to violate the treaty, these things have to be either widespread, long-lasting, or severe. So Air Force 2025 posits, well, if we stay under the threshold, if we're not widespread or not long-lasting or not severe, we can do it. And they have quite a list of things they think they can do under and still not violate the treaty. This is Table 1, Operational Capabilities Matrix. You'll find it in Air Force 2025. One of the papers in Air Force 2025 is Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. And that table lists things they can do to degrade enemy forces or enhance friendly forces. You know, if you can put a GI in the rain and keep him in the rain 24/7 for a couple of weeks, his morale goes to hell. Yeah. And that's one of the things they listed here is we could just make them really, really unhappy. Also, if we could dry up the air, if they're in a position where they have limited fresh water supplies and we dry up the air, they're not going to get any more fresh water. And that could, you know, that can make or break a battle.
Yeah, sure.
The last battle between Indians and U.S. Cavalry in 1906, I think it was between the U.S. Army and Captain Jack and his band of renegade Indians, and they were holed up in the lava beds in Northern California. They had no source of fresh water, and the Army just starved them out. The Army just kept control of the water until they were forced to come out.
Yeah, so I mean it's an old strategy, but they have found, you know, new methods to implement the same strategy, I guess.
Exactly.
Very interesting.
And so, you know, Cohen said that there are rogues, and Cohen implied there were rogue states doing it. And since then, this has been more broadly applied to terrorists are doing it. But it's a very common thing for the military to accuse others of having the capability they have.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, there are a number of ways we can go here. I just wanted to quickly sneak into regarding rainmaking. Have you researched Wilhelm Reich at all?
I do have a section on other technologies. And I have personally researched Wilhelm Reich, and the people who followed in his footsteps, like James Trevor Constable and James DeMeo. I do mention them, but basically I give one or two off-trail alternative technologies to what the mainstream are willing to admit to, and then I say, okay, this would be very interesting, except, you know, I only have 350 pages to deal with here. So if you want to know more about it, and I give them a couple of pages of clues of where they could go look to find more on, and then I go back to the mainstream. What I try to do in this book, you know, my first book, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, was very conspiratorial. It was very, what's the word I'm looking for?
Controversial.
Speculative.
Ah, okay.
It went a great deal into speculating about who and why they were doing this.
Mm.
Because the previous book on HARP, Nick Begich's and Gene Manning's book, Angels Don't Play This HARP, gave the where, what, when, how, but really didn't go into who or why.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I picked up from there. My book is the second book on HARP, and it picks up the pieces of the questions they had left out.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
However, in doing this book, I decided to start over again and do like Nick and Gene did, of nail what, where, when, how, and leave it up to the reader to figure out why.
Mm. Ah, interesting. And
so there's very little speculation. Weather warfare, the military's plan to draft Mother Nature, is 381 pages of facts. There is, in the whole lot of it, there probably isn't 10 pages of speculation.
Interesting. And do you want to go into a little bit regarding the how? We have talked about things like cloud seeding and this kind of stuff. I mean, maybe we can go into how HARP connects into all of this as a device, I guess.
Right. Well, remember, one of the things that Cohen said was others are engaging in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. Electromagnetic waves are radio waves. HARP is the world's largest radio broadcasting station, but it's not designed to broadcast for human ears. HARP is designed to inject 3.6 million watts of radio frequency energy into a spot at the very top of the atmosphere. This modifies the heck out of that top of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
This is using electromagnetic waves to modify, to change natural systems, so as to take over control of those natural systems, to induce states into those natural systems for Department of Defense military purposes. HARP weaponizes a piece of the atmosphere.
And it's, this allegedly at first was said to be used as, kind of communicate with submarines because of the low frequency on the waves.
Right. But the original concept, and this was, HARP is something called an ionospheric heater. When you inject all that radio frequency energy into the ionosphere, it heats it up.
Mm.
It heats it up by thousands of degrees. There was an earlier ionospheric heater operated by UCLA, that's the University of California, Los Angeles. UCLA has a heater outside of Fairbanks called High Pass.
Mm.
I forget what High Pass stands for offhand.
Mm.
Sometimes these acronyms are hard to keep up with.
Yeah, sure.
So they can, there are so many of them.
Yeah, exactly.
But High Pass proved that if you heat the ionosphere enough, the molecules will literally blow apart. And when they do that, they give off a scream of ELF, extremely low-frequency radio waves.
Mm.
And this ELF penetrates deep into the earth, deep into the sea, and the waves are so long, they actually circumnavigate the globe. So you can use them to do a number of things all over the planet.
Yeah.
And the Navy realized, wow, we could use this to communicate with deeply submerged submarines.
Mm.
And the Air Force thought we might be able to use this to map underground structures. And the High Pass facility did, in fact, succeed in mapping an underground structure. They used it to locate and accurately map where some old mining tunnels were. In doing that, that's when the U.S. Senate was then contacted and convinced to fund HARP to do those things.
Mm.
And one of the curious things is that this using it to map. The primary reason HARP was funded was to do what is called Earth penetrating tomography.
Yeah.
To locate and monitor enemy underground bases for the manufacture and launch of weapons of mass destruction. Now, the United States Senate has put a couple hundred million dollars into this project.
Mm-hmm.
I at My best guess of the current price tag on this thing is about $320 million.
There we go.
Now, they funded HARP to do this Earth-penetrating tomography, and to date, HARP has never officially admitted to being used to do that, which makes me wonder who's zooming who,
yeah.
as the popular song went. Has HARP refused to do what the Senate paid them to do, or has HARP done it and done it so efficiently they don't want the world to know how good they are at it?
Yeah, exactly. And this, of course, also considering that these waves are able to penetrate deep into the Earth, gets us into the area of geophysical warfare regarding earthquakes and stuff like this. I mean, how can they produce an earthquake with this facility?
I have read a great deal on this, and again, this is a technical issue, and I have to admit to you, I'm not technical. I flunked every science class I ever took except for one semester of geology.
Yeah.
I know about the technical, but I don't really understand the technical. So
sure.
When it comes down to technical questions like this, what I have to do is simply quote somebody who says they understand it.
Sure, sure.
And quote what they say it is,
yeah.
And then hope that I got the right quote.
Sure, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
In terms of how electromagnetic waves can create earthquakes, I'm a little vague. I've read and heard several things. I've done several interviews on this.
Yeah.
And there seem to be half a dozen different ways of doing it, but I don't really understand it.
Seems to be that.
I do have an entire section in the book on earthquakes on demand,
because
it is a very key element of this. I mean, if Secretary of Defense Cohen says they're doing it, I think they're probably doing it.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
it was clear to me that I had to address this at some length.
Yeah.
And so I put in what I know about it, and what I know about it is that there are five or six ways that mainstream science recognizes that humans can inadvertently create earthquakes. One way is you build a big dam and fill a valley full of water, and all that weight of the dam and the water can cause earthquakes.
Mm.
Also know that if you inject fluid into deep underground, it causes earthquakes. It releases strain in the rocks.
Mm.
Also know that if you extract fluid from deep underground, such as oil pumping, you can create cavities which will collapse and create earthquakes. As for how it's done electromagnetically, I take a couple of running shots at it, but I can't pretend to understand it. So it's hard for me to explain it to you.
Yeah, sure.
The
sure.
listener understands it. All I can say is check out the book and see if that clears up your question.
Absolutely, of course. Yeah, and I mean, there are also, you know, other materials such as you know, hurricanes, and I know that you go into this in your book and address this. And I mean, what's your take on it? Do you think that I mean, the obvious thing that comes to mind here is regarding Katrina, because it seemed to be you know, kind of some kind of burst of energy involved into this when it came into the Gulf of Mexico. I know that the nature of the area is that the warm water produce, you know, gets dust that it goes, a lot of energy goes into the hurricane, so it enforces it. But do you have another take on it?
Yes and no. I have a lot of information in the book on the massaging of hurricanes. I mean, it is really, it's the sexy part of weather modification, and it's the area that the United States has been most keenly involved in. The United States government spent 40 years testing theories as to how to move, control, abate, disabate hurricanes. Again, in the book, I do not have speculation. What I have here is a list of facts, is a pile of facts, and we have this problem, as I mentioned, that once the U.S. became signatory to the NMOD convention, suddenly it all stops. Suddenly it all disappears. There's like just a curtain comes down, light goes off. So beyond that point, it's hard to get hard data. Now, prior to that point, we know that there were a number of attempts, and we know how they worked and have some ideas as to how well they worked. The first was Project Cirrus. Project Cirrus was an unmitigated disaster and started what became the standard procedure, which is to deny everything and slap it under secrecy.
Yeah.
Project Cirrus was 1949. Using Dr. Vonnegut's brand new discovery of silver, actually no, it was another theory using dry ice. They dropped scientists at General Electric, working with the U.S. Navy, dropped a couple hundred pounds of dry ice into a hurricane. Now this hurricane was off the coast of Georgia. It was well out to sea. It was not a danger. They dropped the dry ice into it, and immediately, within a few minutes, it suddenly changed direction, came on shore, slamming on shore near Savannah, left 1,400 people homeless, and killed a couple of people. The United States government's immediate response was to slap it all under, make it all classified,
yeah,
so that the lawyers couldn't sue. Meanwhile, GE's lawyers got all over their scientists and vetted everything they had to say. The scientist in charge of the project was convinced, he expressed a 99% conviction that his dropping dry ice into the hurricane had, in fact, changed its direction. And this nowhere appears in any of the publications he ever released in his lifetime, other than the classified secret version that went to the government in 1953. And when the government finally did release the papers to the public a decade later, a panel of peer review panel dismissed it all as being nonsense and bad science. We know from the get that the government and its lawyers have a problem with revealing the truth.
Yeah.
And this is a problem we have, is that if you do weather modification and it harms somebody, that there are lawyers out there who will take the case. After Project Cirrus, there was Project Storm Fury, and Storm Fury used Bernard Vonnegut's concept of silver iodide, and they had this idea that if you could cloud seed outside the wall of the eye, you could change the precipitation and force the wall of the eye to reform in a larger circle, which should reduce the winds, which should reduce the impact that the storm has when it hits. And they were mostly successful with it. Most of the attempts to do this worked, reducing the hurricane's wind speeds by between 10% and 30%. But after the U.S. became signatory to the ENMOD Treaty, the United States government suddenly decides, oh, no, this didn't work. This was inconclusive. No, this is bad science. Nah. We're not doing this anymore.
Oh, my God. So, I mean, this technology is kind of the on-hands technology, I guess, where you physically go and, you know, drop something into the hurricane or just outside it. And I guess the other... the more modern technology is the use of electromagnetic energy to kind of, as you say, nudge the hurricane in this or the other direction, I guess.
Well, there's a lot of different ways to use electromagnetic energies. One is one that's being a joint venture between the Russians and Mexico on the U.S.-Mexican border. There has been, throughout the 1990s, there was a pretty severe drought in northern Mexico. And the Russians came in with a theory that, with a technology that was based on a theory that the U.S. Department of Defense had played with 60 years earlier, which was the DOD in the late 40s had had this idea that maybe you could use ions. Maybe you could use ion generators sitting on the ground, beamed into the sky, to create electrically charged electromagnetic energies, in this case individually charged ions, to work as nucleating material to form clumps of raindrops around, which would fall to Earth as rain. And in just a couple of years of running the program, the Mexican government turned drought into prosperity. And they went from having most of the lakes virtually empty to having most of the lakes virtually full.
I mean, and this again, I mean, on the surface, it is like, oh, I mean, this is great, wonderful technology. Let's use it. And but again, it feels like we are upsetting the balance of the earth, because if you produce rain in one area, you steal it from another. So again, we're back to this controversy of who gets the right to do this kind of stuff.
Exactly. And this has been an ongoing debate for over 100 years. This is nothing new, and it's now into its seventh decade of debate, and still no end in sight.
Could there be, you know, for example, certain Western governments have been already been using and implementing these technologies to kind of, you know, keep, countries in let's say Africa or other parts of the world, Asia, into, you know, kind of this this state where they don't, you know, get enough rainwater and can't, you know, get on their feet, so to speak, industrially speaking.
You know, there has been a great deal of debate and speculation on this subject in the world's press, and particularly on the internet. And again, I try to stay away from speculation on this.
Yeah.
There is a number of things I'm willing to say to you on the air that are not in the book. And so one of the areas that I started to put in the book had, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 pages on, and then decided it ended in speculation, so I ended up pulling it, which was the Russian big wind technology. You may remember in the middle 1990s, there were massive forest fires burning in Indonesia and Malaysia. And the Russians offered a private firm that had been founded by the Russian government.
Yeah, that's right.
Came in and said, "Look, we can generate cyclones. We can generate hurricanes on demand. you give us enough money, and we'll blow your forest fires out." And Malaysia went for it. Malaysia spent a never disclosed amount of money, but seems to be somewhere in the area of $750 million. And the Russians did whoop up their big wind, and it blew the forest fires out. But it also knocked down thousands of homes and did extensive damage throughout Malaysia and Indonesia. Well, we may have seen this in both Katrina and Gulf War II. As you expressed it, as long as the tropical depression is well out to sea, well out in the Atlantic, it doesn't get very big. It often doesn't even form into a true hurricane, and if it does, it only makes Category 1.
Yeah.
But once it gets into the shallow, warm waters of the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, then it really heats up, really develops all this energy, and goes from a Category 1 to a Category 5 and rips the place apart. Now, what we saw in the last year's hurricane season was every hurricane seemed to pick up speed and be pushed into the Gulf as quickly as possible. Barreled straight in one right after another. Now, this year, the exact opposite happened.
Exactly, yeah.
They all just sort of wandered around well out to sea and never became a problem. There is some speculation on why this occurred in the book. Another area is it could be that the Russian big wind was pushing Rita, Katrina, etc. in on us. There's also Gulf War II. When we went into Gulf War II, the U.S. military expected to be just like Gulf War I, that we'd be in Baghdad by Wednesday.
Yeah.
And the moment we launched, suddenly, the worst winds of a century came up.
Yeah, I remember that.
The worst sandstorm of a century happened and nailed our guys down for 3 weeks instead of 3 days. And I'm willing to speculate to you, though it's not in the book, that Saddam Hussein bought himself some time. He went to the Russians and bought their big wind technology.
Ah, interesting.
And blew sand in the Allied faces for a couple of weeks while he got his stuff together and ducked underground.
Exactly, got out, yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting. I haven't heard that take on it before, but absolutely. I mean, if this stuff exists, of course they would use it. Very interesting. I mean, another thing I read very, very briefly about is Project Seal. Do you want to talk about this a little bit?
Right, Project Seal. Now this is absolute fact. This is this really did happen, which is the New Zealand government developed a tsunami bomb during World War II. The head of the project was an Australian scientist who had been lent to the New Zealanders, the Kiwis. The Kiwis spent virtually the entire war working on it, and in 1946-47, they tested it, and it worked. They produced tsunamis with it. But the war was over, and it wasn't needed. And they went, well, war's over, don't need it, and they filed it. 50 years later, they get around to, oh, I guess we can declassify this now. Now, the curious thing is it got declassified right after the 2004 Christmas Asian tsunami, which lent a lot of people to speculate why. What's this odd timing here?
Yeah.
But we do know that, one, there was a tsunami bomb developed, and two, the United States Department of Defense, actually Department of War, then Department of Defense, was keenly interested in this thing and invited the guy who developed it to come watch the Bikini Atoll atom bomb shot. He declined, but the U.S. DOD guys went to his labs, poked around at his stuff and said, man, they wrote back to their superior saying, man, this is really cool stuff. We should give him everything we got that's related to his work and get everything he's got, because this could be as big or bigger than atom bombs.
My God.
And it just sort of went away, just sort of vanished.
So, I mean, this could be used, and again, on regions that are, in areas that are very, you know, sensitive in lowland regions and so forth, especially.
Well, 80% of humanity lives at the beach.
Yeah.
80% of humanity lives at sea level.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you could, with some well-placed tsunamis, you could wipe out half the human population in an afternoon.
My God. And I really, you know, we're going to continue this discussion in about, you know, 6 minutes or so in the subscriber section. And I really want to go into that, you know, get your take on this kind of stuff, how this could be used again to regarding, you know, that this ties in with the overpopulation theme and all of this, that we need to reduce the population on the planet. But before we go there, and before we end this segment, maybe we could talk briefly about chemtrails and contrails and this kind of stuff. You go into this in the book too, correct?
I do indeed. About a third of the book covers the contrail-chemtrail controversy. And the basic controversy is that the sky seems to have changed, the engines seem to have changed, or the contrails left behind by jets seem to have changed. In that recently, contrails don't dissipate. They don't go away. They stay. They hang in the air for hours.
Yeah.
And by late afternoon, the cloudless, clear blue sky of morning has become a milky white opalescence where the contrails emerge together into one vast artificial cirrus.
Yeah.
And there is, of course, a great deal of speculation on the Internet about whether this is some sort of a spraying program. And if it is a spraying program, why? Who's doing it? What are they trying to accomplish? And so what I do is I break the debate down into two big sections. First of all, what is a contrail? And are if what the government says is true, that that there are no chemtrails, that it simply is a natural, if ugly, phenomena, is it bad? And it is very bad. My book, Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature, is essentially a book about global warming.
Yeah.
Every aspect that we're talking about has an effect, has an impact on global warming, and is impacted by the debate over global warming. And the contrails are contributing to global warming, and something called global dimming, which has just recently been recognized. Now, beyond that, I examine, okay, if there is a spraying program, what is the scientific evidence to support that there is one? And the scientific evidence, oddly enough, is really amazing. Now, if you were to Google geoengineering, you will run into the fact that hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars by dozens of agencies, by scientific and governmental agencies across the planet, have examined ways to mitigate global warming, and several studies, several well-funded, big-name studies from major organizations like the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory have concluded that one way to mitigate global warming would be to change the Earth's albedo, which is the amount of energy the Earth reflects back into space.
That
if we can increase the Earth's reflectivity by a couple of degrees, that would prevent that much energy from getting into the atmosphere. So if we really did have global warming taking place, and it really was caused by greenhouse gases, this would balance it out, and we could continue running automobiles and factories and not have to worry about it for some time to come. And the big studies that have examined this have concluded that changing the Earth's albedo by releasing barium and aluminum particles high into the atmosphere is the most efficient way of doing it, but there are environmental and legal hurdles that are essentially insurmountable. So if we were to try doing this, we would have to do it covertly.
Very interesting. And Jerry, we got just 2 minutes left here. And again, I want you to tell everyone how they can get your books and support your work. Tell them about your website. And of course, also when the book is not yet released, is that correct?
The book, as I understand it, should be on a receiving dock at the National Distributor as we speak.
Oh, excellent.
It should be being moved into the warehouse today or tomorrow. It should be being sent back out to bookstores in the next few days. It should be turning up on books on the shelves in bookstores across North America sometime in the next couple of weeks. So by the 15th of December, you should be able to find it in any bookstore in America, with the exception of Walden's. Walden's doesn't play with our distributor. But you can get it in Barnes & Noble, Borders, Tower, etc. You can also get it directly from the publisher, Adventures Unlimited Press. If you order it directly from the publisher, I will be happy to autograph it to you. And you can get it from the website at www.adventuresunlimitedpress.com. You can call us at 1-800-718-4514. That's 1-800-718-4514. If you call during business hours in the Central Time Zone, there will be several young ladies happy to take your call. Or, of course, you can go to BarnesandNoble.com or Amazon.com and order it there and get it for a discount, but you won't get it autographed.
Excellent. So, get the book. And, I mean, this is very important stuff considering that the debate is really heating up, so to speak. And this is important stuff. So, again, Weather Warfare, get the book from Jerry, and we will continue now in the subscriber sections. We will take a short break and we will be right back. We will continue our discussion with Jerry in our subscriber section. we will get into talking about global warming as a created scenario, and what about solar system warming. We'll also talk about alternative 3 and the religious idea of the weather during the end times. Is there something completely different going on here than we're being told? This is the most fascinating interview I've done on weather and global warming, so don't miss this. If you're not a subscriber, sign up and support the program. Thank you all for listening to the show. Also, big thanks to producer and technician Fredrik Palmgren. And of course, big thanks to all our subscribers. We will talk more with Jerry now in the subscribers section, so enjoy that. This is Henrik Palmgren. Until next time, take it easy and take care.